Welcome to Connected Communication, a podcast exploring the intriguing interplay between language, culture, and the brain through the lens of self-awareness. I'm your host, Christine. Have you ever gone on a day of no direction, where you just walk out of the house and let your gut guide you? Left, right, straight, up that road, down that side street. Maybe you've done it in a new city. I like to do it in cities. I call it nearly sometimes intentionally getting lost, because I always know I'm going to find my way back to wherever it is I want to be. It's a bit like that with life. Sometimes we can change direction a little bit. We may or may not know the final destination we're coming back to, but we know there's going to be a destination. Oftentimes, there are people who help us to find the direction again. Today, I'm talking to one of those people who helped me rediscover my direction. Now, before I go into my introduction of her on the podcast, I'm just going to remind you very quickly that next week is the 1 year anniversary of Connected Communication. I'm going to do something for it. I'm in the middle of doing some research and trying to find out as much as I possibly can about those of you who listen, about what people are interested in the areas that I'm talking about, and generally people's feedback from listening to the podcast. So if you're someone who's regular and you've been listening for the year since I started, or if you've joined along the way and you've got any thoughts or feedback you'd like to give me, I'd love to hear from you. Find me on social media, get my email, send me a message, tell me what you think. Even if you hate it, well, I suppose you wouldn't be coming back so much if you hated it. I don't want to talk too much in the intro here because I'll take away from the interview with the person I'm speaking to. She made a real difference in my life. The week that this podcast episode goes live, it's just after International Women's Day. I've been a little bit vocal about women and how we are allowed to speak and use our voices and be a little bit difficult over the past couple of weeks. And it's been a bit uncomfortable for me because at the same time, you know, I'm trying to have my voice accepted and be listened to. But every time I go to stop myself and pull myself back from saying what I want to say, something inside me says, no, Christine, don't do that. Stand up for what you believe in. Stand up for what you want to say. So I'm being a bit mouthy. It kind of also shows me that I'm back to myself again. Another way that we refind our direction. I've edited the episode as best I possibly can, given that I don't know anything about editing. Well, I know a little bit now, that's not true. But I heard one of my podcast muses and somebody whose hug on their podcast I would aspire to achieve talking about audio fidelity in interviews the other day, and I thought, oh, what is that? So it's the best I could do for now with the tools that I have. As I go forwards and I learn more about editing and I get my new microphone in the next few weeks, yeah, it's going to get better. Enjoy it as it is for now. Just as you enjoy the pride in the decisions that you make, because you make them with what you have at the time that they're made. Today I'm speaking to my first coach and neuro-language coaching trainer, Rachel Paling. Rachel is one of the people who's had a huge impact on my life. Her career started out in law and human rights studies, but a language interest always bubbled under the surface. Having achieved distinction in spoken Spanish when she graduated, love and language called, and instead of pursuing a career in law, she combined her expertise and began coaching top executives across Europe in professional English. She's added multiple qualifications and certifications since then, an MA in applied neuroscience, another MA in neuroeducation and neuropsychology. As an ICF professional certified coach, she's the creator of Neurolanguage Coaching, the first ever ICF CCE accredited program for language teachers worldwide, the one that simplified science for me. Later, during the pandemic, I think, which I'll confirm in a minute, Rachel set up the NeuroHeart Education Foundation, and the accompanying ICF accredited course for teachers of any discipline to become Neuro-Heart Education Coaches. Her mission is to transform the educational process in schools, universities and corporates worldwide. A mission very much close to my heart. Rachel, thank you so much for coming on to the podcast. I'm very excited and blessed to have you here.
Oh, honestly, Christine, thank you for inviting me. And, you know, you're reading it and I'm going, wow.
It is a great bio and one to be proud of, for sure. Let me go to first, what brought you towards neuroscience?
Interesting question, isn't it? I think, you know, listening to the bio, there is one thing just to maybe clarify. Actually, language came first because I started teaching when I was 17. I started teaching in Spain, I moved to Spain, and I started teaching English, and law came later. And the language pattern was always present, as you said. It was always bubbling in the background. I was always teaching. Even through my law studies, I was teaching to earn money, to pay for the studies. And so it's always been the motor of my life, even. And back in the 2000s, when I then fully dedicated to language, actually, it was 2003 when I moved to Germany. I was fully focused on language training, teaching, and coaching, because the person that I went to work for, the school, was focused on developing language coaching. And I decided to train myself as a life coach to find out, well, what is this about? And how can I incorporate this into language coaching? And fate had it that I found David Rock's courses. And David Rock is the one who created Results Coaching System and also now NeuroLeadership. And that was my first introduction into neuroscience. Now, for me, the fascinating thing was not only neuroscience, but also how we learn languages and how we can combine that and what's actually happening when we learn a language and how was I learning languages and how can I enhance the language learning process with coaching and with knowledge about the brain? And I think that's when it was, for me, it was an eye-opener of how to manage my own brain. And I think this is where each and every one of us, that curiosity really hits us hard. Because at the end of the day, it's not only about neuroscience and the scientific aspect, it's about us and how we understand firstly, ourselves, to then help others to understand themselves. And that was it. That was the point of entry for me. And it just got deeper and deeper and deeper, like I know it has for you and for many other people as well.
Self-awareness is a word that comes to me there. It starts with the self and the recognition and understanding of the self. So what did you notice about yourself, how you were learning languages and what was happening in your brain?
Well, in that period of time, I'd already accumulated French from school, Spanish from living in Spain and being married to a Spaniard, Catalan from living in Spain but never having lessons. And in that period, I moved to Germany and I was struggling to learn German because I was also traveling to Italy at the same time. And so my Latin brain was naturally going into Italian first. And I was naturally picking it up, no lessons in Italian. I literally just converted my Latin pool of knowledge into Italian. And it through the years, it just worked just by being there. But I was struggling with German. And I even remember thinking, what's wrong with me? I can speak all these languages, but I can't get German. What's wrong? And that's when I started to realize just how similar German is to English. And the Germanic side of German, as soon as I started to see those patterns, the door blasted open for me with German. It's really about how to bring, again, we come back to the word, awareness to the brain. And when the brain starts to pattern and to notice, the brain does it by itself. It's fascinating.
It is, most definitely. Two words come there for me, which I think connect. Acquisition. So I heard the mention of when I started to acquire. I had acquired French at school and then I was acquiring Spanish and Catalan and patterns. So how does that go together, the acquisition and the pattern?
Whenever you say the word acquisition, Krashen comes to mind. You know, it's like Stephen Krashen, woof, Stephen Krashen was a genius, you know, he really was, because he always distinguished between language learning, which is that sit at school, learn rules, grammar, theory, and then acquire with input. And I didn't realize that for me, Spanish was very much a reflection of both processes. So French for me was a reflection of explicit input, learning at school, language learning. At the age of 15, I met my future Spanish husband. We met on holiday, 2 weeks, and I was determined to go back home and learn Spanish. So I actually spent 2 years studying Spanish. So that language learning period for me was writing letters for 2 years. And probably I got to a C1 level in my written Spanish. I couldn't speak a word. But then when I moved to Spain, it was how to then bring in the acquisition and marry my language learning with my language acquisition and the implicit to be able to then become fluent in the language. It took me 6 months.
Okay, so I'm going to get a bit selfish now. I recognize some of the acquisition, of course, coming. The more I speak to people, the more little things get reignited in my brain. I spent 4 years at college at 18 studying Spanish, and I was probably C1 finishing. I could speak it well and write and read it well. My reading's still pretty good.
Yeah.
So what are some tricks you have for me to open up this acquisition now that maybe I've blocked or I haven't yet turned the key on?
Definitely, definitely bombard your brain all day, every day, with Spanish as much as you can, only Spanish. So that will mean Spanish television, Spanish friends, Spanish music, Spanish everything. So that literally you're saturating your brain with the language. And I know that you've moved to Spain, so you're doing that.
Yeah, starting with the TV.
Right. And I remember watching TV and not understanding a word. And after 3-4 months, that was it. It was like magic. So I would say perseverance to not understand. That's the key. And the more that you can go into those relaxed states, so they were talking about, you know, I love brainwaves, alpha, theta, even when you're sleeping, you know, bombarding the brain a little bit, something in the background. Those states are the subconscious brain states. And that's where really, you know, that part of the brain is absorbing, taking note. Right. And then just keep using it, keep using it, keep using it. Perseverance.
Super. Yeah, I've found a channel called TV Consciente, which is that relaxed yoga TV. And I sat one afternoon and watched, I don't know, 4 hours, I think, on it, on the history of tea in Spanish. But by the end of it, it was coming. And you make me think of an experience I had, I think, in my late teens, sitting at home in my mom's house, 2 o'clock in the morning, and I got into this zone watching a film in Russian. And suddenly I was watching it and I was understanding it. And of course, I don't speak Russian and never studied Russian. And as soon as I realized that I was understanding it, I didn't understand anything anymore. But it was this moment of what just happened to me? How did that happen? Something hit. Okay, thank you for that. And the same for anybody who's listening, of course. It's not just a tip for me being selfish. It's anybody who's experiencing language in the same way. So brain waves, right. That brings us to the conscious and the subconscious, which I know you have a keen interest in. What are some of the findings you've experienced or the things you've discovered with respect to the conscious and the subconscious, the influence on brainwaves and these patterns coming up that we can find?
I think it is about the understanding that, you know, our conscious brain is the brilliant rationalizer, analyzer, but it's also the brilliant interferer. And the more that we let it interfere with that all-knowing, perfect subconscious brain performer, the more that it interferes, the less that we kind of do. And it's interesting, you know, when you, for example, let's take a very simple example. When you want to go to the gym and your prefrontal cortex is saying, oh, I'm lazy, don't want to go. No, don't have time. Oh, it's too cold. You know, that power to say, shut up, get in the car, just go. And that's almost like what we do sometimes with learning. We kind of block ourselves by saying, oh, I can't do this, I never do this. And it's how can we have that power to just say, look, sit with it, try it, do it, no judgment. It's almost like we've got part of our brain, which is the judgment part. And as we say, that interferes. So I think what I've learned is to really appreciate that part of my brain more, because it really is useful at times, but also to really understand when not to allow it to run wild and to calm it down, which is what we do when we meditate, when we go into relaxation. This is what we do when we go in the flow. This part of the brain becomes deactivated. And then allow the rest of the brain to come out to play.
Yeah.
And it does. And that's when we get more coherence, more flow.
Yeah. Judgment, the power of judgment comes up there. As you say, that the positivity that it can have, it's got a function and a purpose to help keep us safe. Going to that judgment, what I've noticed in myself when speaking Spanish with people is how different my capacity to speak Spanish is and my accuracy in production and my fluency, depending on who I speak with. So yesterday we had a combined intercambio thing that I was helping with, and there were some English students who were learning Spanish. And because they're younger, they're learning, they were afraid. My Spanish was coming out. I still got blocks, but it came out quite freely compared to if I speak with somebody else I know who speaks Spanish fluently, is not of Spanish descent, but is a teacher and I know judges me and wants to correct my Spanish immediately. So my Spanish isn't as good. So in those moments, I like what you said there, I've learned to appreciate that part of my brain, sit with it and respect it. What are some techniques that you have to help people who notice that in themselves, that flick of judgment, depending on who they're speaking to? And how can they overcome it? Particularly maybe at work. You know, we talk about corporate environments. Oh, there's the boss. I'm gone. I can't communicate now. The boss is in the room. He leaves the room or she leaves the room. I'm okay now. Mm-hmm. But what can they do?
I think there's various things that can be done. I think one thing you've just said there is firstly to notice. And this is really the major, major step, to notice what's happening to us when we're in those situations. Because most of the time we don't notice, we just get in it and we get lost in it. And then the emotions take over, then the nerves take over, then, you know, we've gone. We spiraled into that emotional down twist. So noticing first is key. After noticing, it's then about building up the strategies. Now, I am all for honesty and actually, you know, quietly saying to the boss, you know, may I share with you that when I'm with you, I struggle with the language because I'm nervous. I have this feeling that, you know, obviously you are my boss. If there is that possibility to speak to that person and share with them what you are experiencing, the more you can label those emotions and get it out there, the more you neutralize them. And we know that as well from the neuroscience. There was a great experiment with people who had fear of spiders. And the ones that actually went in and labeled their emotions, I'm afraid, I'm terrified, were the ones that actually demonstrated less fear later. So labeling those emotions with that person is key. If that's not possible, I would say then, unfortunately, rehearsal is key. Keep doing it, keep doing it, keep doing it, keep noticing, keep seeing what happens, and then build in strategies. Maybe there's going to be breathing techniques. Maybe there's going to be, okay, I'm going to think about, I don't know, love, as my boss is speaking with me. I'm going to think about puppies and to try to divert that reaction that's potentially going to lead to a fight or flight reaction as well. So those are my three tips: to notice, either address it instantly with the boss, this is what's happening, honesty, or notice and then build up those strategies and keep doing it and keep doing it and keep doing it.
Yeah, and I do the same with speakers and presenters. I have actually in one of my training decks a picture of an elephant in an office. Address the elephant in the room. Okay, everybody, this is the first time I've spoken about this topic, so bear with me. And As soon as you do that, everybody now cares because they want to help you succeed. We go in with this thinking often that people don't. The word focus came into my head there as you spoke. I'm hearing a lot recently about language switching, code switching, and brain freezes or brain burps, they might be called in some of the work. What happens there when we're in the middle of speaking and suddenly, the language is gone or another language is trying to feed through?
It's interesting because, you know, when we speak many languages, all those languages are present in our brains. So, you know, when you do speak multiple languages, they're all present and the brain is suppressing the ones that you're not speaking. So it's very natural to really understand that from time to time, there might be that sort of, you know, the pressure cooker valve might suddenly, oops, pop open and another word comes out from another language, or the word might just be so confusing that, you know, where, as you say, you've got that brain freeze. And again, I think it's about just going with it. The more you do it, the more you do it, the more you do it, the more the brain gets used to code switching. And it's brilliant brain gym. It really is. You know, when you're tripping in and out of languages. But just a funny story to share with you. When I was doing my law studies, I was working for a law firm. I was doing some extra work as a student. And one of the things that I was doing was actually interpreting in prison and going to prisons, interpreting for Spanish-speaking prisoners, and even going to court and interpreting as the interpreter. And I'll never forget, with the lawyer, I was accompanying the lawyer on a prison visit, and we were talking, you know, that sort of English-Spanish. And there was one moment that my brain just got so fused with everything. I was speaking Spanish to the lawyer and English to the prisoner. And it was like, he was looking at me going, Rachel, change chip. And it was like, whoa, I need a moment. So I think, you know, and I really believe that the UN interpreters are only allowed to be there for 10, 15 minutes, and then they have to change. Because it is so much energy for the brain to be going from one language to another, to another, to another. The fuel, the energy, the focus. Incredible.
Thanks for sharing that story. For anyone who's listening, particularly if monolingual, if only someone who speaks one language, it's hard to understand and recognize the work that a person is doing when having to switch between their languages and under pressure, maybe tired to meet deadlines, for them to be able to do that and have that compassion to say, okay, this person's working doubly hard. I need to have a bit of compassion here and a bit of patience to let this go at the pace that they need.
Absolutely. And Christine, let's add, when people are learning, I have a lot of teachers coming to do my course from who are not native English, and they're doing the course, they're learning in that non-native language. It's amazing. The same as you and I when we do courses in other languages.
Oh, I don't know if I've done a course in another language yet. Well, I suppose when I'm listening to things and I'm doing my studies in Spanish now, it's a little bit course-like. And yeah, the tea was a course. I was learning about tea.
For you, you know?
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, it is. It's phenomenal that people have the capacity to do it and to push themselves through it. I was thinking before we talked about ebbing and flowing and energy and finding flow. We need that bit of resistance and we need the force to pull back and push to be able to find the flow. It's like anything, any form of energy. So you went from language into language coaching, then into neuro-language coaching and developing this groundbreaking and world-changing study. I do believe that it is. For me, when I did that neuro-language coaching course, it not only affirmed the way I taught, because I really taught in the way that I then learned to be a neuro-language coach. I always challenged with questions and thinking, and I put up tables and said, what do you know? And so for me, it was really brilliant because, okay, I'm actually doing this. This is wonderful. But then to put the science behind it, to give it that backing, I went on and did do the results-based coaching course with the Neuro Leadership Institute to supplement it. And I mean, the rabbit holes of neuroscience that I go down now for learning are just so deep and I keep going. But I've you to thank for that. And I really mean that. I will never forget that your course opened my brain up to the possibility that I could have science in my life and neuroscience and apply it all. So I really do mean it. And anyone who's listening, I urge you to look into it, especially if you're an educator. It is game changing.
Yeah, thanks. And Christine, just to add, you know, you, like many, many, many teachers out there, I think you're intuitively, you came to the course intuitively doing so much. And I think that each and every one of us were trying to adapt to the learners of today. And that sort of dimension of the science is something that many, many teachers are terrified of. And just by, you know, sometimes I get accused of not being nerdy enough and not talking nerdy enough. I'm more interested in reaching millions of teachers so that they understand it and so that they can then bring it to the kids. We need kids to understand this. We need little kiddies of 5, 6, 7, 8, teenagers, you know, in their 20s. We need them to really take control so that they bring in that self-awareness and manage their brains. So, yes, it is absolutely this simplification, but not only the simplification, it's the implementation that's the key. Because everybody's regurgitating the science, but they're not living it. And this is where you, me, now, we are living it. And that's the difference.
And it's phenomenal how interested people are in it. When I start to, you know, with permission, can I share something about the brain? Of course, share it. And you start to share it in that simple way and maybe bring in a phrase like you talked about the bubbling, the pressure point of the cooker. I talk about a volcano. When you bring in something that relates to the mind, that pressure bubbling underneath and then it blows over. Or but there was one I had with a client, the devil is in the details, for that focus model when we focus on the vision and not the detail. Mind blowing. In a moment, the mind is opened up and moved forwards in a way that it didn't realize it could. But I think to add to what you said is that when this work is done by an adult and they start to flip from directive to connected, they find a different type of respect for the young person and for the coachee or the client or the student and start to ask them and suddenly realize, you actually know a lot more about this than I thought you did. You know, it's like that brain-led development. A couple of my sisters are using brain-led development with their kids. And I mean, climbing walls at 2 years old, you know, because you just let them. It's phenomenal. So you move then on from neuro-language into neuro-heart. What's happening there?
You know, I think through the years, we really have seen how a lot of the teachers doing the neurolanguage coaching course are so like-minded and so full of desire to change, but with that loving desire to change, you know, that sort of really heartfelt desire. So the more we come into, and the science is moving this way as well a lot, we're looking at heart-brain coherence a lot more. And that's a fascinating area because now they're really understanding that the heart maybe has much more of a major role to play than the brain.
Oh, yeah.
Quite understand how to understand the messages because there's more messages from heart to brain than brain to heart. And sometimes we think that actually the brain is sending messages and that's what's then getting the brain into action. But it really is... You know, we need to move into the heart more in this world of today. You know, that compassion, that altruism, I'm going to really say, because I think we know one of the greatest neuroscientists looking at altruism is Dacia Keltner in the US, Berkeley. And, you know, some of his work is phenomenal because, you know, there is a basic premise that we really are all wanting to help each other. It's not the survival of the fittest in this world. That's not our natural state. Our natural state is to really care for each other and want the best and to, but obviously life gets in the way and we seem to be, you know, pushed away from that natural state. How can we bring that back? So Neuroheart is really that question of how can we bring in not only the brain, the neuroscience, but bring in the compassionate coaching, but also bring in the emotional intelligence, the heart science, so that we're bringing in a very holistic approach to education. And that's the reason that we're moving in that direction. And you're right, in the pandemic, a lot of people may not realize this, but we did the conferences that we normally do face-to-face, we did them online. And the profits that we got from those conferences, we plowed back and still are plowing back profits to create the Neuroheart Foundation. It's a Spanish foundation. It took us nearly 2 years battling with the Spanish authorities to get it up and running because they didn't like this or this was not. We did it. So actually, we got the final permission to be up and running last year. And obviously, we're doing everything from nothing, Christine. We're literally creating from nothing, exactly the same as neurolanguage coaching, which was created from nothing. This is also being created from the nothing. And now we're doing a charity dinner to raise funds. We've got all the courses that we want to bring. And the courses from the foundation are really focused at helping teachers, firstly, helping them to enhance teaching with neuroscience coaching, heart science, positive education, whatever we can. Secondly, to help with teacher well-being. And thirdly, to help with learner well-being. And those are the courses that the foundation will be offering. And hopefully, once we get going and we get funds coming in, we can then dedicate it to other projects, like maybe bringing languages to children in countries that don't have the opportunity, or helping language teachers who need more help from volunteer teachers on this side. Or maybe we can bring, I don't know, computers to remote places on Earth where they can then hook up to satellites and get online sessions. Projects that, you know, I really open that space to see any project that could enhance education anywhere on the planet. That's the vision.
Love it. Yeah, and that's what we saw. There is this true connection that we have where we do want to help each other. And like you say there about the foundation and neurolanguage coaching, it being created from nothing, the earth is the same. Everything is created from nothing. There's an explosion of energy, an idea forms from it, and then suddenly this fiery ball of beauty comes from it.
Yeah.
So we're coming close to the end of our conversation today, but I hope there'll be many more.
Me too.
For those looking to make some sort of change for themselves, to find that connection with the heart. And for me, the heart always comes first. I firmly believe, think, opine, whatever form of word you want to take, that the heart comes before everything. That's core. That's where core comes from. Heart, courage. For those who are finding that connection in themselves, that core, that courage, that heart, but they're a little bit afraid, what would you say to them to help them take one step into curiosity towards a possible change?
You know, as you were saying that, I was thinking, yes, everybody's different. So I think one of the key things is to know thyself and to really start to see what resonates and what dissonates with you, your heart, what you want. And then the fascinating thing, to really try to separate out or siphon out the beliefs of what others wanted for us in life and what we maybe wanted or didn't want. So I think it's always a game of sort of siphoning out, sifting through. And when something resonates and it's something that you would really love, then I would say go into feeling it, seeing it, visualizing it, to really get used to that sort of, well, yes, this is what it is, this is what I want, and this is how I feel it, and this is, and that will normally help to open up the pathway.
I love that siphoning. gives a nice imagery to it. And for me, give yourself permission to explore, permission to change, permission to be different, permission to say, no, that's not what I want anymore. Permission to feel the pain of separation, because some people aren't going to like the changes, and step forward in that courage. And I might add, actually, for those who are listening and are a bit afraid of the science, I got an E in science in my junior cert, which is a fantastic fail. Despite having had chemistry sets, making crystals as a child, exploring the anatomy of worms and different things in my garden, you simplify it. You really, really do. And I love how you simplified it.
Mm.
We can make it more complex if we want to after that.
Absolutely.
So thank you. Thank you for being here. Thank you for coming on. Thank you for entering my life when you did.
Thank you, Christine, for entering my life when you did. It works both ways, you know?
This is very true. And for all the work that you're going to do.
And you too. We'll get our heads together.
Definitely. So listeners, you're not seeing the video of this. If you do want to see the video of the interview, you can go online. But Rachel and I came on the call today wearing exactly the same colour without any plan or intention to do it. If ever there were synchronicity, that's synchronicity right there. A lovely blue too, the blue of communication.
Yes, yes, yes. Turquoise at its best.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that's it. And the sea, which I talked about last week. The sea and the brain waves and frequency and resonance in the podcast episode. So it's definitely flowed beautifully. As always, those of you who are listening, thank you for listening. If there's someone you feel may be inspired by this conversation, may be interested in changing their direction as an educator or a teacher, is full of heart and wants to direct it in a particular way, do go to the show notes. You'll be able to find Rachel's links, find her on any social media channels. She's everywhere. Look for the Neuro Heart Education Conference. Share the episode, like the episode, follow the podcast. And good ye on Kate or Ella. Until next time, Banakti agus buíochas. Thank you, Rachel, so much for being here. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.